Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The new book by novelist Colson Whitehead has been getting huge attention lately, and for good reason. It's a fantastical treatment of the escape from slavery, and it's called The Underground Railroad. Lately, there's been something of a boom in works about the Underground Railroad, and my colleague Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor at The New Yorker, is at work on a book of her own. In her case, it's strictly historical.
It's about three women in upstate New York who all come from the same town, and they're all conspiring on the Underground Railroad in different ways.
So there seems to be a phenomenon right now where you've got real writers working on the Underground Railroad, both from a fictional point of view. There's a new television show called Underground that just was renewed for a second season. HBO has a project about Harriet Tubman. The great Eric Foner, historian of the Civil War and Reconstruction, had a book about the Underground Railroad in New York City. Why all of a sudden? Why does this happen?
I've been thinking about this a lot, actually, because the HBO movie, which is supposed to come out, I think, next year or the year after, is based on a nonfiction biography of Harriet Tubman that was written many years ago by Kate Larson. But why now? They've rediscovered it. And there are other movie projects in the works as well. I think there is a perfect storm. We have this African-American president who made his name first in 2004, saying there's not a white America, there is not a black America, basically saying there is one America. Unfortunately,
yeah,
almost 8 years
out?
Later, we've seen that that's just not so. And we've come through Baltimore, Ferguson, Charleston, the horrible mass shootings in the
Black Church.
But why
the Underground Railroad as opposed to 15 other subjects?
Because it's a myth of origins, and I think it has the combination of the horrors of slavery, and there's also this inspiring, heroic tale where white and black Americans worked together for more than 50 years on what was essentially a guerrilla operation and did it very successfully. There were very few cases of betrayal. And I think people feel at moments of racial tension, which is what we're experiencing right now and have been for several years, that we need to go back and rediscover that. And some people want to do it like Colson Whitehead. They want to do it through fiction. I was interested in doing it through nonfiction.
And you had some experience with Colson recently.
I did. And it's an absolutely terrific novel. And I was particularly interested in going out with him and talking to him because he's also a New Yorker, and he's played in really interesting ways in all of his books with time and place. So I thought, well, let's take a walk. I'm here with Colson Whitehead, and we are standing at the corner of Church Street and L'Esplanade. So this building was an actual station on the Underground Railroad, although the building, of course, has been completely redone since then.
Yes, outside of a restaurant. There's a plaque on the wall.
On September 3rd, 1838, human rights activist Frederick Douglass escaped slavery in Maryland by disguising himself as a sailor and traveling north by carriage, train, and boat. A few days later, he arrived at 36 L'Esplanade Street, then a small brick building and a station of the Underground Railroad. A network of secret conductors and safe houses for fugitive slaves.
I never noticed it before. I have walked by here many times, and L'Esplanade Street is actually my last novel, Zone 1.
Many, many fugitive slaves found their way to New York. And of course, your book fastens on another facet of that and then plays with the whole idea of the Underground Railroad.
Yeah, I mean, I think... the Underground Railroad, when you first hear about it, you think it's a literal subway. I think most kids, when they first hear about it, that's what they think. And I was like, what if it actually was a literal underground network of tunnels? Once I make the leap of having literal Underground Railroad, I'm freed from reality.
Some atmospherics here since we've just descended into the depths of the New York subway system on an August day.
Uh-huh.
It is not the most pleasant place to be, although obviously nothing like what your heroine Cora experienced in the course of the book. One, if you would mind reading just a very short passage, I think it's only one paragraph, where we are actually in your Underground Railroad.
Right. The stairs led out onto a small platform. The black mouths of the gigantic tunnel opened at either end. It must have been 20 feet tall, walls lined with dark and light-colored stones in an alternating pattern. The sheer industry that made such a project possible. Cora and Caesar noticed the rails. Two steel rails ran the visible length of the tunnel, pinned by wooden cross ties into the dirt. The steel ran south and north, presumably, springing from some inconceivable source and shooting toward a miraculous terminus. Someone had been thoughtful enough to arrange a small bench on the platform. Cora felt dizzy and sat down.
Having the train be literal, what did that make possible for you?
Well, once I'm not sticking to the historical record, it allows me much more play with time and theme. If I'm not worried about getting certain details right, I have the latitude to make her journey through time as well as space. With every state she passes through, all the sort of, her sort of horrible adventures, there are all sort of stops on a journey, I guess, through wisdom. I reread Pilgrim's Progress, which I hadn't read since high school, and Pilgrim is tried in various ways by the world, and each sort of adventure brings him closer to God and fulfillment. And Gulliver's Travels, it seems, you know, it's a great structure for storytelling.
And when you were writing the book, what were some of your literary influences? I know you've talked about slave narratives.
So 100 Years of Solitude, which I read in high school, had a certain impact on me then because I used to read a lot of horror and science fiction, and magic realism became like a different way of using fantasy. There are different ways of bending reality. So when you move from these different states, from Georgia to South Carolina to North Carolina with their different schemes, North Carolina is a white supremacist state. I think originally South Carolina was set in the future and it was very hyper-modern, and North Carolina was very conformist and took place in a kind of 50s suburb. It seemed maybe if I dialed down some of the fantasy, it might work better if it was more matter-of-fact, in the same way that the slave narratives, the way they were matter-of-fact about torture, brutality, just life on a plantation, it seemed being sort of plain-spoken about it would be a good strategy.
Did you know there's some extraordinary details about the experience of slavery? So one of the ones I was struck by, the little tiny manacles with the tiny chains for children. Does that come from your reading of these narratives, or did you just kind of let your imagination?
It's both. I remember reading about, you know, once a year we'd get wooden shoes from master. I'm like, you wore wooden shoes? Like, I never heard of that. Once you start trying to build out a world from these small facts, you get into, you know, tiny manacles for children.
So our next stop was Plymouth Church in Brooklyn Heights. Do you know it, David?
I don't.
Well, neither did I, actually, until I started writing my book. It's one of the reasons I wanted to go there. It's an amazing building. It was built specifically for Henry Ward Beecher, the famous 19th century preacher.
Related to Harry Beecher Stowe,
yes,
who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin?
Yeah, absolutely. Beecher used his pulpit basically as an abolitionist propagandist. I mean, it was an overtly political institution. He even held mock slave auctions where he presented actual slaves and had his congregation buy their freedom. It's a beautiful old sanctuary. The church's executive administrator, John Sebelia, took us into the basement, which was this amazing warren of little rooms under the sanctuary. You couldn't have done it better yourself.
So we are in the Underground Railroad underneath Plymouth Church. People could get in from the outside, often without being seen. What you see here, the brick and the stone, are original, and that's what was here in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. So just imagine in this room, no lights, not sure when the door would open, if it was your food or if it was someone with a gun.
Yeah, it's musty and dank, and you know, the ceiling is about six feet high, so you're crouching. Although people were shorter back then, I think. So my Underground Railroad is obviously more fanciful, and it's described like a subway station, and some are Some are very plain, some of the stations, some are well appointed with like food and candelabra and stuff like that. So it's nice to see how reality's version of the story.
I'd also love to have you read another passage while we're down here, because I do think that this, I believe it's when Cora is in North Carolina and she's taken in by a white couple who are agents on the Underground Railroad, but very reluctant ones, especially the wife. So they take Cora up to the attic with a little peephole that looks out to the outside.
Yeah, it's based on the story of Harriet Jacobs, who was, I think, in North Carolina, if I'm remembering correctly, fleeing her master, who had sexual designs on her, and hidden in an attic for 7 years. So there's the, you know, the echo of Anne Frank. In North Carolina, in the book, it's a genocidal white separatist state. And she can't go outside because she'll be lynched, so she's trapped in the crawl space. Cora had been feeling poorly all day. She said goodnight and climbed into her nook. For all the close calls, she was in the same place she had been in for months, becalmed. Between departure and arrival, in transit like the passenger she'd been ever since she ran. Once the wind picked up, she would be moving again, but for now, there was only the blank and endless sea. What a world it is, Cora thought, that makes a living prison into your only haven. Was she out of bondage or in its web? How to describe the status of a runaway? Freedom was a thing that shifted as you looked at it, the way a forest is dense with trees up close, but from outside the empty meadow, you see its true limits. Being free had nothing to do with chains or how much space you had. On the plantation, she was not free, but she moved unrestricted on its acres, tasting the air and tracing the summer stars. The place was big in its smallness. Here, she was free of her master, but slunk around, a worn so tiny she couldn't stand.
And she, when she's up there, she thinks back to this little tiny plot that she had cultivated when she was still on the cotton plantation, which was, I think she just grew yams, essentially, and she was modeling this after the life that her mother had lived before she fled slavery and Cora was left an orphan.
Yeah, she has a tiny garden on the plantation, basically her only possession. Now she saw it for the joke it was, a tiny square of dirt that had convinced her she owned something. It was her like the cotton she seeded, weeded, and picked was hers. Her plot was a shadow of something that lived elsewhere, out of sight. The way poor Michael, reciting the Declaration of Independence for the amusement of their master, was an echo of something that existed elsewhere. Now that she had run away and seen a bit of the country, Cora wasn't sure the Declaration described anything at all. America was a ghost in the darkness, like her.
So this passage is one that I will never forget, honestly. And it's partly is because it's so beautifully written, but also in the course of my own reading and reporting and thinking, and the slave narratives I've read, it just kept striking me over and over again that the Declaration of Independence meant far more to these slaves, illiterate slaves, than they did to people who already, really not very many years after it was written, were taking it for granted.
Sure, I mean, all men are created equal refers to white men. Women couldn't vote. Obviously, black people had no status. And so the Declaration of Independence appears in different times of the book. In the early part of the book, there's a slave who's recited it the way a parrot does tricks for his master. And then when she comes to I call it the Black Utopia, this free farm in Indiana, the free children are learning to memorize it in a different sort of way than the slave did on the plantation.
And tell us a little bit more about that free utopia, because there, too, you're playing with all kinds of different themes, real and imagined.
Well, there's the seemingly benevolent South Carolina plantation. And then eventually, she finds her way to Indiana on a farm owned by a free black man. And, you know, they're debating what's the next step for the black race in America. Do we go back to Africa? Can we save the slave who's been so debased? Do we want to assimilate? Do we want to be separatist? And so, because I've already made the metaphor of the Underground Railroad into a literal railroad, I felt free to mix and match speeches from Booker T. Washington and Du Bois and Frederick Douglass. And then all those debates over who we can save or can't save still go on today. You never get out of the ghetto unless you act proper, act white. Can we save those lost souls in the inner city who've been ravaged by drugs? And so all those debates that we hear now from Al Sharpton and various people were raging 200 years ago.
That's Colson Whitehead with Dorothy Wickenden. Colson's new book is called The Underground Railroad. I recommend you read Catherine Schultz's great critics piece about the novel and many of the other recent fictional works about the railroad. She looks at how the Underground Railroad is recapturing the national imagination and how stories about it have a complicated relationship with the truth. You can find a link to that piece at newyorkerradio.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.